Without more ado, I call upon Comrade Hardy to begin his lecture on nationalisation and privatisation.
Mr. Chairman and comrades, at the forthcoming general election, a year or so's time, among the other things the electors are going to be asked is whether they approve or disapprove of the Thatcher government's action in privatising, as they call it, nationalised industries, that's selling them back to private companies to operate. The Tories will say that privatising them will be good for everybody, and the Labour Party will retort that it's bad for everybody. Now, this is, of course, the loose way politicians talk, because almost all the things that governments ever do are good for some sections of the population and bad for some other sections, and there are always some people to whom it doesn't make the slightest difference whether the thing happens or whether it doesn't. Well, we're going to answer this question in relation to nationalisation and privatisation. The Labour Party, as you all know, talk as if nationalisation is the special hallmark of the Labour Party, a statement which is quite untrue. The Liberal and Tory governments were nationalising before the Labour Party was formed. The present Tory government has denationalised the telephones. Well, who nationalised the telephones in the first place? The Tories started it and the Liberals finished it, and they both accepted it as the normal practice for something like half a century. The same applies to other Tory and Liberal governments in the past nationalised some industries to achieve a particular object. In other words, they were behaving rationally and as people with a certain responsibility for running capitalism. Now the Tories have decided that the object they wanted to achieve by nationalisation in the 19th century no longer serves their purpose, because they can get the same object in a different way. The only political party in this country that has never advocated nationalisation or supported nationalisation or defended nationalisation is the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And likewise, of course, we've never advocated, defended or supported private enterprise. Our object is to get rid of capitalism, not to play about with ways in which capitalism can be operated. First, a word as to what exactly nationalisation means. An industry or service is said to be nationalised when it's taken out of the hands of private owners and is owned and operated by the government, either directly through a government department or indirectly through setting up a public board like British Rail or Coal Board, and having them run the industry on the part of the government. In the 19th century, the postal, telegraph and telephone services were operated by the post office as a government department. The staff were civil servants, and they were just like any other government department with certain differences. Later, nationalisation took the form of what they call public boards, as when the Labour government in 1945 took over coal, steel, railways and various other industries. The theory is, about these nationalised boards, that the government provides the finance, say of the Coal Board or British Rail, and exercises some control, but the day-to-day operation of the Coal Board and the railways and the steel industry is supposed to be left in the hands of the members of the board itself. But the government, of course, appoints the members of the boards and can remove them if at any time they want. Usually they appoint them for 3 years and then replace them by somebody else. Now, the same kind of organisation exists when local authorities operate commercial services, such as water supply, bus services and council houses. There is one municipality in this country, Hull, which also operates a telephone service by licence from the post office, from British Telecom. That's the city of Hull. Back in 1889, when the Fabian Society, which is affiliated to the Labour Party now, they've always provided a lot of the theorising for the Labour Party, they published Fabian essays in 1889, and they held out the prospect that the local authorities would take over a whole range of services and run them in competition with private industry. Well, that expectation has not been fulfilled, and as I say, the kind of operations run by local authorities have been fairly narrowly restricted. That's just an accident. But as far as the government itself is concerned, there has been a whole lot of nationalisation. I've mentioned some of the commercial industries and services, coal and railways and steel, that have been nationalised, but there are a lot of other fields which in the past 150 years the government has taken over that were formerly carried on by private individuals. And I have in mind health service, the education service, the turnpike roads, unemployment and old age pensions. At one time, what education people got, they paid for themselves, they paid schools, or they went to the church charity schools, or they got no education at all. For health, they paid doctors or hospitals, though the hospitals were largely dependent also on donations given to them by the public. And until the government took over road building, part of the provision for trunk roads was in the hand of private companies. They were called the Turnpike Trust. The trust, the capitalists would get together, set up a turnpike trust, take over the building of some miles of roads, and they got their profit by charging users tolls for being on their roads and using them. As for workers who became unemployed, they had to depend either on their own savings or on what benefits they might have got through having contributed to trade unions and unemployment benefit, or to the friendly societies, or in the last resort, they depended on charity or went into the workhouses. Likewise, when workers became too old to work, they again had to depend on their savings or any pensions they may have paid for in the trade unions and the friendly societies, or again to depend on charity. Now, these arrangements have all been taken over by the government or by local authorities, and the cost has been enormous. I mentioned last time I was speaking here that in 1886 the expenditure of the government in a year was 92 million, and in this current year it is 128,000 million. When you've made allowance for the fact that the prices are now nearly 40 times what they were in 1886, the cost of government has multiplied by 35 times compared with what it was 100 years ago. And the reason is that the government's taken over all these functions: health, education, unemployment pay, old age pensions, and so on. When any of you have tried to examine the arguments about nationalisation, the kind of arguments the Labour Party would put up in favour of nationalisation, or the others would put up against nationalisation, you may find it full of confusion. And the confusion is that while governments may act quite rationally and nationalise an industry for a real solid sort of purpose, in the political field they all talk very loosely. You would get the Labour Party didn't only advocate nationalisation for a particular purpose, but they made a principle of it and said, look, we are totally in favour of all nationalisation. The Tory politicians then retorted and said, look, we're against nationalisation. And of course it's created an enormous amount of confusion. For example, the President Winston Churchill, a Member of Parliament, wrote a letter to the Times not long ago saying that the Tory party was opposed to nationalisation because nationalisation is socialism. Well, he'd forgotten the activities of his grandfather, Sir Winston Churchill, who was a very active nationaliser and carried on campaigns for nationalisation often. It was, for example, a Tory government which in 1844, and I emphasise 1844, not 1946, passed the first act giving the government power to nationalise the railways. It was what is called a permissive act, and I'll deal later with the reasons why the Tory government should have passed it at that time. Then you have Churchill and Lloyd George, just after the First World War, carry on a campaign for nationalising the railways. Their idea was to run the railways at cost as a sort of subsidy for British manufacturers and exporters. And it was Sir Winston Churchill who, a few years later, in 1943, gave a radio broadcast, this was in the middle of the war, in which he said there is a broadening field for state ownership and enterprise. obviously intending, had the Tory government won the election in 1945, that the Tory government would itself have gone in for some nationalisation, probably coal mines, and I'll come back to that later. And it was another leading Tory politician, Lord Beaverbrook, who in his Express newspapers for years carried on a campaign for nationalising the Bank of England, which eventually the Labour Party did in 1945. And it was Lloyd George, the Liberal, who when he was Prime Minister after the First World War, made the statement that his government had decided to nationalise the coal mines. Not long after the Tories chucked him out, and they never did in fact carry through that promise by Lloyd George. Now, I've said the Labour Party has made a principle of it. They say we're in favour of nationalisation anyway. But if you look at Labour Party statements, you find they are equally confusing. For example, it was Philip Snowden, who later became Chancellor of the Exchequer in a Labour government, who defended the Labour Party's advocating nationalisation on the ground. He said, we're not doing anything more than the Liberal Party would find acceptable. And it was, although the Labour Party claimed that the nationalised post office was a form of socialism, the man who became first Prime Minister in the Labour government, Clement Attlee, who had himself been Postmaster General, wrote an article in a magazine in 1931 describing the post office, and I quote, as the outstanding example of collective capitalism. And it was another minister in a Labour government, Lee Smith, who said that the Port of London Authority was the latest development in socialist theory. Herbert Morrison, later deputy leader of the Labour Party, agreed with Lee Smith. And it was Herbert Morrison who in 1929 introduced a bill nationalising London passenger transport service. The Labour government was thrown out of office before they finished it, and the Tories finished it. The Labour government started, the Tories finished it. But the interesting thing about that, it was Morrison who, a few years earlier, writing about this same Port of London Authority, which he accepted as the model for the London Passenger Transport Board, described it as, and I quote, a sort of capitalist Soviet and thoroughly objectionable from a Labour point of view. Just to finish this round of muddled statement, it's worthwhile bringing into the picture Lenin, the leader of the Russian Communist Party. Bismarck, in Germany in the 1870s, was responsible for nationalising a lot of German industries, partly for military reasons, and one of them was the post office. And Karl Marx's colleague, Friedrich Engels, writing about it, said it was deplorable that misguided German social democrats should have welcomed what Engels described as a sort of spurious socialism. Engels said, if nationalisation is socialism, then we ought to say that the founders of the socialist movement were Napoleon and Metternich. And he threw in a crack. He said, are we to suppose that the Prussian government state brothels are socialism too? That was his answer to them. But now look what Lenin said. Lenin, writing about it in his State and Revolution, made this rubbishy statement, and I quote, a witty social democrat of the 70s of the last century called the postal services an example of the socialist economic system. This is very true, says Lenin. This was Bismarck's post office. And of course Engels had already answered it. So you see, they've all created a lot of confusion as to what exactly they mean by nationalisation, even when they either advocate it or oppose it. They've all got themselves into a shocking muddle. The Tories are now set on a course of denationalising the nationalised industries. The Labour Party still wants more nationalisation, but they've watered it down and given it a new name. They now call it social ownership. And the Liberal Social Democratic Party Alliance, so far as I can discover, are still sitting on the fence as they were at the last election. They say, look, we don't want any more nationalisation, but we also don't want to denationalise anything. So for the time being, the Liberal SDP Alliance can't really be held responsible for anything. But now, to get it all into perspective, look at the record of the parties. The postal service was nationalised in the 18th century and continued all through the 19th century and up to this century by both Liberal and Tory governments. The Post Office Savings Bank was started by the Liberals in 1841. I've already mentioned the Railway Nationalisation Act of 1844 by a Tory government. The telegraphs were nationalised in 1868 and 1869. The Tory government started it, the Liberal government finished it. In 1871, a Liberal government gave the government power to take over the railways in time of war. In 1889, the Tories nationalised the cross-channel cables and added them to the post office. The telephones were nationalised between 1880 and 1912. The Tories made the first move, the Liberals carried it on, and they both accepted, they're both responsible for it. Port of London Authority 1908, a Liberal government. Central Electricity Board 1926, Tory government, Mr. Baldwin. The next year, the BBC, and again the Tory government, Baldwin. London Passenger Transport Board, Labour started it, Tories finished it. British Overseas Airways Corporation 1939, the Tory government, that was Chamberlain. And coming right up to date, when Rolls-Royce went bust in 1974, the Tory Prime Minister, with Prime Minister Heath, the Tory government, nationalised the aero engine section of the former Rolls-Royce company. In view of this record, you can understand what Herbert Morrison meant when, in 1944, in the course of a speech to some schoolboys, he was telling them all about the nationalisation. He said this, he told them, "More socialism was done by the Conservative Party, which opposed it, than by the Labour Party, which was in favour of it." But of course, translated this into truthful English, more state capitalism was done by the Conservative Party, which advocated it when they wanted it, and later on were going to change their minds about it, than by the Labour Party, which was in favour of it. Well, that last bit is true. The Labour Party were always, so to speak, in principle, in favour of this. I shall explain later on why the Tories and Liberals were in favour of nationalisation at that time, and why they've changed their minds. But just a word about privatisation. It's a rather hideous word, but people know what it means. This privatisation by the Thatcher government isn't the first. In 1928, the Post Office beam wireless telegraph service, which they had rented from Marconi's, was so successful, it was so much cheaper, that it was undercutting the private cable companies and driving them out of business. And to save the cable companies from bankruptcy, the Tory government denationalised the beam telegraph service. In other words, they handed it over from the Post Office to a private company, the Cable and Wireless Merger, for the purpose of saving the cable companies from being driven out of business. And after the Labour government nationalised iron and steel in 1946, the next Tory government denationalised it, and then when the Labour Party came back in 1965, they nationalised again. So you've had some denationalising as well as nationalisation has gone on before. Back in the 1930s, a rather rash assistant postmaster general, a Tory, made a speech in which he advocated that the telephone service should either be put under a board, or, alternatively, that it should be denationalised and handed over to private company. Nothing was done about it. They set up a committee of inquiry, which recommended various things, but they recommended against doing that. It's also interesting to notice this. Naturally, reading English papers, you may get the impression that privatisation is a peculiarly English custom, but it isn't that at all. When the Mitterrand government came in France, they nationalised a lot of banks and insurance company. They were defeated, not the president, but the government was changed. They got a Tory government in, and the present Tory government in France is now denationalising the banks and insurance companies that were nationalised a few years earlier. In Austria, the government has told the nationalised industries that if they don't stop making big losses, they will be denationalised. In Japan, the postal service has already been denationalised, handed over to private company, and they are now in process of denationalising the Japanese state railways. The Turkish government is privatising the nationalised banks in Turkey. In Portugal, in 1975, they nationalised more than half Portuguese industry. the government now wants to denationalise it, but finds that there's obstacle in the Portuguese constitution, and they're now busily engaged in altering the constitution so that they can denationalise them again. And in Germany, the German government's policy is to denationalise some state industries in Germany, but so far they've made no progress because they met with opposition inside their own party and in the nationalised industries themselves. There is also America. In America, in 1975, half a dozen company railways went bust, and the government had to step in and take them over to keep the railways running. They're now trying to sell them back, but so far have been unable to get anybody to offer them the price that they think acceptable, but presumably they will continue with this, and they will eventually denationalise these railways. In all of the cases I've mentioned, all these countries, the reason has been the same, either an allegation of inefficiency or that they're making big financial losses. And just the last postscript to this, British Telecom, having been denationalised itself, has set up a department whose job is to go around the world to make a little money by offering to advise other governments how they can denationalise their telephone services, for which of course British Telecom will want to be paid. One of the reasons why the nationalisation picture is so confused is that the purposes for which governments have nationalised industries have varied from country to country and from time to time, partly due to different countries having reached different levels of industry and finance. Take the railways, for example. In this country, early in the 19th century, all the factors were present for railways to be set up by companies with the certainty that they would make profit. In other words, the traffic was there, the traffic was already being carried on the roads, by wheel traffic on the roads and on the canals, but the railways could do it cheaper. And also there was abundant capital looking for investment in Britain. So there was no reason at all why the government had to step in. The companies stepped in, they set up the railways, they were enormously profitable, they drove canals and the road transport people out of business, but I mean that's the way things go. In America and some continental countries, the situation was different. The traffic didn't exist. For example, in America, particularly owing to the enormous distances to be carried, the traffic for the railways to carry was not already in existence, and the capital wasn't there to develop companies to do it. What had to happen, the government had to step in, or the state governments in America, had to step in, provide the finance, build the railways, and then the fact that the railways were built would then build up traffic for the railways to become profitable. But after a big financial collapse in 1837, the law was altered so that the state governments in America could no longer provide finance for the railways. But in the beginning, the government had to do it. Later on, when the traffic had already begun to develop and plenty of capital was available, the American railways were set up by private companies. Another factor which is everywhere present to some degree about building roads and railways was the military question. In France and Germany and other continental countries, which were land powers, the military factor was foremost in the building of roads and railways, not only the building of them, but deciding where they were going to be built. In other words, Germany wanted railways built where they would be available for the invasion of France or Russia, for example. They couldn't just leave it to companies to build railways where they were profitable. So in France and Germany, the governments took over the roads and railways from the first. In Britain, a sea power, the military factor was in roads and railways was less important. So for a time, as I've already mentioned, the trunk roads in this country were being built by the Turnpike Trust companies for profit. Later on, it was decided that they were not developing fast enough, and the government handed over the building of trunk roads in this country to the county councils. If you take the telegraph service, it was developed in Britain by private companies, again because the traffic was there and there's plenty of capital available to invest in them. But in France, the first telegraphs were built by the army for the use of the army, and the public weren't even allowed to use them for years before they would let the public use the French army telegraph service. And also in later years, a lot of industrially backward countries, for the same sort of reasons, lack of capital and lack of development, have had to step in to build basic industries. Their steel industry, their coal industry, have had to be done by the governments because capital wasn't available and they couldn't at that time leave it to private companies. In some of these cases, Turkey's one of them, the government stepped in and set up these various industries, and at a later stage the government stepped out and handed them over to private companies or the private companies to carry on. I now want to look a bit more closely at nationalisation in this country. Taking first the non-commercial nationalised services, the one I've mentioned, education, health, unemployment and old age pensions, the government took over elementary education because industry and commerce were saying to the government, look, it's not good enough for us to have apprentices who learn the techniques of the industries. We want people with a general education in order that British industry can develop. And they looked to Germany. Germany had done it already, and Germany was making rapid industrial strides, overtaking and eventually passing the British industry. And as I say, the capitalists here said to the government, look, you can't any longer rely on people having to pay for their education or going to the church charity schools. So they nationalised education in the 1970s. In other words, the government took it over entirely. As I say, in Germany, they had already done it, and the British government was partly, at least the people who were advocating this, looked to Germany and said, look what Germany's done, we need to do the same. As regards the health service, it was a similar sort of story. The Germans were in first with this sort of thing, and both in the First World War and in the Second World War, the authorities here were appalled to discover the low physical condition of the millions of people they've called up under conscription for the army. As regards unemployment, this also was borrowed from Germany. Germany was first in state schemes to provide doles for the unemployed workers. And of course it had the great advantage, and this is one of the reasons behind it, that once the government provided unemployment pay, they have put an end to these incessant unemployed riots and marches. I mean, you look round, how many of these have taken place now? Hardly any. I mean, the unemployed, so to speak, have been bought off by this government provision of unemployment pay for the unemployed. Another reason, of course, is that when the workers got the vote, in the 1860s and 80s, the Liberal and Tory party now had to compete for workers' votes, and of course it had to be right at the forefront of their campaigning to say eventually, look, we're going to set up an unemployment scheme, which of course they did, a very comprehensive one, when the Labour government came in 1945. Same with regard to old age pensions for people who were too old to work. In 1911, Lloyd George started it, and he reckoned at the time that it would be cheaper to pay people, I think the amount was 10 shillings a week, it would be cheaper to pay the people at age 70 10 shillings a week rather than have them going into workhouses where they cost a great deal more. A last point on this, although the so-called welfare state combining health service, sick pay, unemployment pay and the rest of it were introduced by a Labour government in the 1945 Labour government, all of these things had been agreed during the war by the coalition government of Tories, Labour and Liberals. They had all agreed to it and were all more or less committed to the same sort of things had the Tories or the Liberals or a mixture of them won the 1945 election, which of course they didn't. When we come to the commercial nationalisation, the postal and telephone services, coal, steel and so on, the considerations were different. The problem there was the problem of monopolies. Now, Karl Marx pointed out long ago, there is a natural tendency for capitalist industries to go in for monopoly, in other words, to get together. For two reasons. One, that with the development of machinery, the amount of capital required to run an industry becomes ever greater and greater, and so they need to get together to provide the amount of capital. Also, if you could get the capitalists in a particular industry getting together with a monopoly, they could then charge what prices they liked and make super profits. That, of course, is what each individual group of capitalists would like to do. But if any of them succeed in doing it, the rest of the capitalists are, of course, up in arms about it. The rest of the capitalists do not want to pay through the nose in order to be able to use some monopolist service. They, therefore, are strongly urging the government all the time to deal with monopolies. Well, there are two possible solutions to a problem of monopoly. One is that you break the monopoly up, which is a system the Americans have more or less consistently used. The other thing is to nationalize it, put it under government control, where the government can, though it is a monopoly, the government can keep the charges low and maintain certain standards of efficiency and provision of national service and so on. Well, in the 19th century, the Liberal and Tory governments favoured the nationalisation solution. As I said, in America, they, after a lot of attempts and giving it up and trying again and so on, the American governments have favoured the antitrust solution. And you will all of you read 2 or 3 years ago, following a decision in the American Supreme Court, the American government broke up what was the biggest and richest corporation in the world, the American Telephone and Telegraph Corporation, which had got a monopoly of the American telephone service. That is the line the Americans have taken. Well, what's happened now, having had experience of nationalization and finding that a lot of conditions have changed, the Thatcher government has decided to change its line. They still want to deal with monopoly, but they have decided that it's no use trying to deal with it through nationalization of industries. So they have turned to the American system. In other words, the Tory government have strengthened the anti-monopoly laws and are hoping to deal with the thing in that particular way. It has an interesting sideline on this. You will all of you know that Thatcher frequently makes speeches saying that she's in favour of small companies. She wants small capitalists to thrive and or get going and try to make a do of it. Well, oddly enough, in 1921, it was the deputy leader of the Labour Party, Kleins, who wrote this. He said, "The Labour Party prefers a large number of small capitalists to a small number of large capitalists." In other words, Mrs. Thatcher, I don't suppose she did, she could have picked this up from the Labour Party of 60 years ago. But now you can see why the Tory and Liberal governments were in favour of nationalisation in the 19th century. And apart from the postal, telegraph and telephone services, I've mentioned that in 1844, a Tory government passed an act giving them power to take over the railways. Well, what had happened, the railways had got a monopoly of transport. They'd driven the canals out of business and the horse-driven vehicles on the roads. They could charge what they liked. They charged high prices. And they did something else that a lot of the capitalists found particularly infuriating. They would reach an agreement with a favoured customer, and they would let a particular customer use the railways at a lower cost than his rivals. Well, for all these reasons, they got together and pressed the government, and the government passed this act, which was saying to the railways, "Look, either you mend your ways or we shall take you over." Another interesting thing about this, it was a Tory government, but the minister who carried it through was Gladstone. He was at the Board of Trade. Gladstone started life as a Tory minister, changed over and became leader of the Liberal Party. His rival, Disraeli, started as a Liberal, changed over and became leader of the Tory Party. And it is an old English custom, as you recall, that Sir Winston Churchill started as a Tory, became an independent, then a Liberal, and ended up as leader of the Tory Party. These professional politicians carry on in this particular way. And of course, I've already mentioned that in 1921, Lloyd George and Churchill were advocating nationalisation of the railways for the reason I gave, to run them at cost as a form of subsidising British production and British exports. As regards telegraphs and telephones, they both of them were nationalised on the demand of business people, chambers of commerce and so on. And what they had against first the telegraph and then the telephone companies with this. Telegraph companies, there were a number of them, were in business to make profit. They would therefore set up their telegraph offices and their telegraph lines in the places where there was a lot of traffic. Around the Stock Exchange, for example, and in Fleet Street for the newspapers. And later on the telephone companies did the same. They would concentrate on the towns. No telephone or telegraph company wanted to build lines out into the rural wilderness or the lonelier parts of Scotland and so on. So the business people got together and they said, we want a national service and we want the thing to be spread into rural areas as well as the rest. And it was for these reasons that capitalist pressure was behind the government in nationalising telegraphs in 1868 and the telephones later on. One interesting thing about this was when the telegraphs came first and the law gave the post office a monopoly of the telegraph service. When the telephones came on, the post office took a case to court and got a High Court to hold that for the purpose of the Act, a telephone is a telegraph, which of course the companies opposed. It was one of these cases where the courts can use a bit of common sense and say, look, we want to cut out a lot of waste of time. Let's say that the telephone is a telegraph, and then the government post office will automatically have a monopoly of the telephone service. But of course, the other thing behind the telegraphs and the telephones was this. First, the telegraph companies were merging together and approaching a monopoly, and later on, the telephone companies were merging together and approaching a monopoly in the National Telephone Service. So they had this reason that they did not want the telegraphs or the telephones to have a monopoly. And so, like the other things that the Tory and Liberal governments did, this fight against monopoly, they all fall into line. Now, this was the thread that ran through the 19th century. But now we come with conditions different, and the Thatcher government has decided that no longer works, and the way to do it is to use the American antitrust system, which has been the example of which has been followed in this country. Of course, in the meantime, with long years of nationalisation is not the vote winner that it used to be. There's no doubt whatever that in 1945, when the Labour Party said we're going to nationalise a whole lot of industries, it was a vote catcher for them and enabled them to win the election. But people have had a lot of experience now, and I don't think many people look at it like that. And I'll put this to you. In 1920, Sir Leo Chiozza-Money, an economist who had been a prominent member of the Liberal Party and joined the Labour Party, wrote a book about nationalisation, which was full of examples of nationalisation all over the world, and the claim that they were all making profit and so on. Well, in the latter days, of course, the outstanding feature of nationalised services, not only here but a lot of other parts of the world, they don't make profits, they make losses. And I put this to you, would anybody dream now of publishing a book with the title that Sir Leo Chiozza-Money gave to it? He called it The Triumph of Nationalisation. Well, I don't think a publisher who got out a book like that now with so many copies. But behind the Labour Party's enthusiasm for nationalisation was a very interesting economic theory that people have paid too little attention to it. Karl Marx pointed out that rent of land, industrial profits and interest on borrowed money are all of them part of surplus value that the capitalist gets by the exploitation of the workers. That it's just surplus value is the lot. It is divided in practice into industrial profits, rent of land and interest on capital. In other words, if you have a factory owner who doesn't own the land and has to borrow money, he doesn't pocket all the profits he makes. He has to hand over a share to the people from whom he's borrowed money, maybe the banks or somebody else, and to the landlord if he's rented land. But they're all the same sort of things. They're parts of the exploitation of the workers. Now, the early Fabian society, though they were not Marxist, accepted this. They said, you know, no difference, rent, interest and profit, all the same sorts of things. But later on, Professor Tawney, in a book called The Acquisitive Society, produced a new theory. He said that rent of land and industrial profits are quite different from interest. He said that interest on borrowed money is a natural and necessary feature of all forms of society, whether capitalist or socialist. And J.R. MacDonald, the leader of the Labour Party, who was their first Prime Minister, took over this theory from Tawney. Tawney had a lot of influence in the Labour Party anyway. He accepted Tawney's theory. Here is a quotation from MacDonald's book, Socialism, Critical and Constructive, published in 1929. And I quote, "When labour uses capital and pays it its market value, property is defensible." Now you see, if you take the view that rent, interest and profit are all the same, they're all exploitation, property isn't defensible. I mean, nobody can put up a defence for it. Here's Tawney and MacDonald saying property is defensible if labour uses capital and pays it its market value. MacDonald was also a leading member of the Independent Labour Party, which was affiliated to and supported the Labour Party. And here's a quotation from an Independent Labour Party pamphlet called How Socialists Would Run Industry. This was published in 1924 when there was a Labour government. "Why should not Labour hire capital and devote the whole of the surplus to the improvement of the service?" And another Independent Labour Party called Socialism in the Villages said this: "There is every reason to expect that agriculture will yield a far better return to labour and capital than it now does." In other words, you've got the Labour Party rejecting entirely Marx's view about exploitation, and incidentally rejecting the Fabian Society's view of it, coming over to the Tawney view and making this queer distinction between one form of property income and another. And the one thing that MacDonald and Tawney and the Labour Party have consistently have always said is you hire, to use their phrase, is you hire capital to run a nationalised industry, but the people who are lending you the money must in no circumstances whatever have any hand in the running of the industry, and this they have been quite consistent about it. And with one small temporary exception, there never have been any shareholders in nationalised industries who could sit on the board, have votes, play any part whatever in the running of the industry. The only small temporary exception was that London Passenger Transport Board, where one of the class of shareholders had not a fixed rate of return, but a variable one depending on the profits in the London Passenger Transport Board. And the lawyers got busy on this and said, well, if the interest they're going to receive on the money they put into London Passenger Transport Board is going to depend on profit, they've got to have some form of hold over it. And so they got written into the London Passenger Transport Board a provision for them, if necessary, if they didn't get their money, to go to the courts and get London Passenger Transport Board, as it were, declared bankrupt. And there's never been any such provision in the other industries, so to speak. Once you've got a nationalised industry, there's no existing provision, as it were, for getting rid of them, merely because they make big losses. But you see what all this means. When the Labour Party nationalised the mines, the railways and so on, when they paid £1,000 million to the ex-railway shareholders, the shareholders were then right out of the business. They had no further part in whatever. They were in no way dependent on them, and it didn't matter to them, once they'd got out, whether the coal board, the railways, anybody else made a profit or a loss. They were out, they got their money, it was absolutely guaranteed, because the bonds they received weren't charges on the coal mines or on the railways, they were charges on the treasury as part of the budget. So you see what this means. Of course, I just want to make the point perfectly clear. If the whole of the coal mines went out of existence, the former shareholders in the coal companies would still go on getting their money. And if all the railways were wound up, the ex-railway shareholders would still go on getting their money. And as I say, in this, the Labour Party have been consistent. They've always said, you know, we'll compensate them, but we won't let them play any part in the industry once they've got out. Coming back to this Labour Party, independent Labour Party concept of hiring capital and paying interest to the lenders, they thought it would work like this. They said the land would be nationalised, so all the rents would come to the government. The owners of the nationalised industries would no longer receive profits, they'd be compensated in getting out, so all the profits would come to the government. And the only charge the government would have in the nationalised industries would be paying interest to the people from whom they had borrowed money. Now that looks beautiful on paper, and as they saw it on paper, they thought, look, there's going to be enormous surplus coming into the hands of the government for the government to do what it liked with. They said, look, you know, we should have an enormous amount of money. We've only got one charge on it. We're going to get the profits, we're going to get the rent. We only have to pay the interest, and we should have a lot of money left over. And they said this big surplus fund should be used to improve the service, to lower the charges and to raise the wages of the workers. That, of course, was their dreamland. But now look at what actually happened in practice. They had made the assumption that capitalist companies always make profits. They forgot all about the times, of course, when capitalist companies make losses and go bankrupt. They didn't think that depressions would ever happen again when they had accepted the old Keynesian rubbish. They thought that there were not going to be any more unemployment, no more depressions. So they ruled out the possibility that a nationalised industry could run into depression. So they were quite certain, you see, that they were going to have plenty of money to spare and would be able to do all these things, raise the wages of the workers, improve the service and reduce the charges. Lloyds Bank, three or four years ago, tabulated all the financial returns of all the nationalised industries for the 17 years from 1961 to 1977. Now, I've told you what the dream of the Labour Party was when they nationalised. I now read out to you the reality. I quote, "The table shows that the financial surpluses of the public corporations have at no point been sufficient to cover the interest costs on their accumulating debt in addition to wages and salaries. They have therefore had to borrow growing sums to pay the interest that they could not cover from their sales revenues." In other words, instead of the government having an enormous income coming into it and only having to pay out a little interest, it's had to borrow money actually even to pay the interest, because most of the nationalised industries have run into great financial difficulties. And as I just say, that was up to 1977. In one later year, 1980, the total subsidy of the government to the nationalised industries for one year was £1,800 million. And as I've already explained, the only people who never had to worry about it are the former shareholders, because they were getting their money. It didn't matter to them whether the nationalised industries were profitable or not. There have been changes in the form of nationalisation. When the postal, telegraph and telephone services were nationalised, they were government departments, the staff were civil servants, they were under very, very rigid treasury control. There were treasury people, so to speak, sitting in the post office watching every penny they spent. I remember on one occasion post office official saying to me that he couldn't spend more than 5 quid, as it were, without getting treasury permission to do it. Slight exaggeration, but that was the sort of thing that it was. And they had a political head, the Postmaster General. Now, you often get people saying, look, why, when the government points a minister in charge of a department, don't they charge a man who knows all about it? I mean, why don't they put a teacher in charge of education, and a railwayman in charge of railways, and a coal miner in charge of coal mines? They don't understand the Constitution. The job of the political minister, apart from telling the departments what they've got to do and carrying their views back to the government, the job of every minister is to prevent the government from spending too much money. That's what they're there for. So it is a fact and the post office is no exception, there has never been a postmaster general appointed from within the post office. The postmaster general was appointed there to carry on the treasury work of keeping down post office expenditure, because the post office surplus, as one of the revenue departments, went to the Chancellor of the Exchequer as part of his budget revenue. And along with the other revenue departments, Inland Revenue and Customs and Excise. But being a government department meant that every detail of post office expenditure had to come before Parliament. Several times a year and continuously, every detail of post office estimates had to go before Parliament, where every MP could they'd get opportunity of debating it. They could look at everything, every item of expenditure, including, of course, every item of expenditure on wages, and the wages of all the, I don't know, something like 100 different post office departments. MPs would try to burrow into these and express views about them. And then in 1930s, when the Labour Party were getting ready to come into office again and carry on a lot of nationalisation, Herbert Morrison and others pointed out to them that they could no longer run nationalised industries as government department, because if they did, the whole of Parliament's time, all the year round, would be taken up with discussing wages and all the other things in nationalised industries. So he said, you've got to get it away from Parliament. So they invented this board system where the government appoints a board, the government provides the finance. The board is supposed to have day-to-day responsibility for running the particular department. But in all the nationalisation acts setting up these public boards, they're all of them required to pay their way, in other words, to make a profit. And the practice has existed in recent years, both Labour and Tory governments, of saying to the post office and the other nationalised industries that there's a certain target of profit they expect them to yield based on the average yield on capital in private industry. Now, because the nationalised industries are now not exactly popular, the Labour Party has decided to invent a new form and give it this new name, social ownership. And they've announced the details of it at present with regard to British Telecom, which has been privatised and has got shareholders in the British Telecommunications Company, including a lot of the staff. The Labour Party are going to revert to a form of nationalisation, and what they've said to the people who are now shareholders, we shall take away your shares, but we'll give you in return an interest-bearing security, but it will not give you any say whatever in the running of the company. Some difficulties have arisen in the past and are going to arise in the future about the nationalised industries. And they've never been solved. They concern the relationship between the public boards and the government and Parliament. I've said that in theory the boards are supposed to have sole responsibility for day-to-day operations, but all the boards, whether under Labour governments or Tories, have complained bitterly that they're continually being chased and harassed by ministers trying to interfere with the day-to-day operations, including their charges and the wages they pay and all the rest of it. And the MPs complain that whereas under the old post office form they could always raise questions in the House of Commons about post office because it was a government department, they haven't got this facility with regard to the nationalised industries. All the nationalised industry boards want to have financial autonomy to do what they like about raising money and so on, but I don't think that any government is ever going to let them have it. They've never let them have it in the past, and I can't see them doing it now. We now come to the question we put at the beginning, that when the Tories would say privatisation is good and the Labour Party would say privatisation is bad, and the question arises for us, how does it affect the working class? Look at what the Labour Party claimed when they went in for nationalisation. They said that the nationalised industry would be more efficient and more profitable. Absolutely nothing in this. I mean, a nationalised industry can be efficient, as the post office used to be, It can be profitable, as the post office used to be, or it can be very inefficient or very unprofitable, as some of the later ones have been, just like any private company. There is simply nothing in this. The Labour Party said that the nationalised industries would pay higher wages to the workers they employed. Right in the early days, when the Fabian Society launched this, but wrote it in terms of municipalisation, of local authorities taking over industries, they actually had a very funny passage written by Bernard Shaw. He said, look, as soon as local authorities take over industries, they'll put up wages, but he said, well, they mustn't put up wages too much and too fast, because if they put them up immediately, all the workers employed by private companies will come on the doorstep of the local authorities wanting municipal jobs, so they have to do it very gradually. Well, if you can think back to the Winter of Discontent, for example, 1978-9, when the Callaghan Labour government was trying to keep pay increases down to 5%, when prices were going up by 10%, the people who were striking against him were a million or more local authority workers. In other words, Bernard Shaw's dream of the local authorities paying more than everybody else just didn't work. In the ups and downs of wages, it can happen from time to time that people in nationalised industries or in the civil service get more than people outside. Other times they get less. It's just the way the thing goes. And it can happen both ways. In the 1920s, for example, the government set up special economy committees to look into the fact that, as they said, certain industries, including civil service and post office, had got rates of pay above those in outside industry which had fallen. Whereas in the last two or three years, it's been the teachers, the health service workers, and the civil servants are all complaining that they're getting paid less than their opposite numbers in private industry. The thing can happen both ways. In the post office, right at the beginning, the head postmaster in every district used to recruit some grades, like postmen, at whatever he could get them to accept according to local rates of pay. Later on, they set up a system by which Parliament would appoint a select committee which would take a thorough look into every detail of post office pay and make recommendations accordingly. Later on again, they came into line with the civil service, the Civil Service Arbitration Tribunal, and the very elaborate system of pay comparisons that was set up in 1955 and which has now been suspended. But in all these systems, you see, the key factor all the time about the pay of people in the nationalised industries is what people are getting in private companies. I mean, at all of these things, the thing would be argued backwards and forwards. Both sides would put in information about it. The other thing, and this particularly appealed to the trade unions, the other thing Labour Party promised about nationalisation was that it would give people job security. Well, how wrong they were. There have been hundreds of thousands of railwaymen and steel workers lost their jobs in the last 10 years, about 500,000 miners, including, by the way, the 1965 Labour government with its national plan, planned to get rid of 179,000 miners. The reason being that the mines were being run at a loss. And it actually says in the plan, we are closing down loss-making pits as quickly as possible. I mean, this is something, of course, that has got to be, if nationalised industries are to be run at a profit, and if the demand changes and they're going out of business, just like any private company, they can't give job security. In the last 2 months, there have been three reports in newspapers about coal mines being closed down and miners losing their jobs. The first was in this country. Our nationalised industry announced last week they're closing down some mines in Scotland, and they reckon that 10,000 miners' jobs will disappear. My second example is from Japan, where the mines are privately run. They're closing down loss-making pits in Japan, and 14,000 miners are losing their jobs in Japan. My third example is from Hungary, where, of course, the mines are nationalised, and capitalism in Hungary is run by a self-styled communist government. They're closing down pits, and the miners have been told they've got to work longer hours in order to make the mines profitable. In all three cases, of course, it's exactly the same, that the mines are losing money. Just a glance in the 19th century, the post office always had a queue of people wanting to get jobs in the post office. And it wasn't so much the pay wasn't particularly attractive, but it was because they did have a job for life, they had quite generous sick pay, and they had a non-contributory pension scheme. In later years, of course, other industries have acquired these things and the post office has ceased to be the attraction that it used to be. During the war, the other thing, of course, the Labour Party said was, when all these industries are nationalised, the workers will feel that the industry belongs to them, so they won't come out on strike against it. In 1943, during the war, Winston Churchill made that statement of his about there being a broadening field for state ownership and enterprise, and as I say, I think he probably had in mind the coal mines. A few months later, Harold Laski, a prominent member of the Labour Party, wrote an article in Lord Beaverbrook's Evening Standard appealing to Churchill to announce the nationalisation of the mines to improve the war effort, to get people to fight more willingly in the war. This is what Laski wrote. The effect on output, on absenteeism, and on strikes would be immediate and important. And 3 years later, the Labour Party carried that out with their widespread nationalisation, and you know the result has been. Since all these industries are nationalised, the majority of all strikes are now in nationalised industries, because the workers soon found out that nothing had changed in nationalising the mines and the other industries, except this, that in the mines they were dealing with several hundred mine owners linked in the Mine Owners Federation. When they were nationalised, they're dealing with only one board. And of course, the outstanding case of all this was the miners. For about 50 years before the mines were nationalised, the miners' unions and the Trade Union Congress carried on a campaign for nationalisation. When the Labour Party came in 1945 and introduced a nationalisation bill, they actually consulted the Miners' Federation, the worker of the union, about what was to be in the bill, and they agreed, and they all voted for it. In 1946, they got the mines nationalised. Well, now just think. 1926, when they were fighting the coal owners, the miners came out on strike for 7 months, were shatteringly defeated by the mine owners and the government. 60 years afterwards, in 1985, the miners again come out on strike. They stay out for a year, and they're shatteringly defeated by the coal board and the government. And this is the coal board they spent 50 years urging the governments to introduce. So to speak, they got they were responsible, but it's hardly what they expected. So what's our case against nationalisation? The Socialist Party of Great Britain never joined in the Labour Party campaign. We never advocated, defended or supported nationalisation. Nationalisation is state capitalism, except that the ownership and control is vested in a government-appointed board instead of a company board of directors. Nothing has changed. The aim is the same, to make profit by the exploitation of the working class. In 1981, the chairman of the Post Office Board, who had been appointed by a Labour government, made a speech in which he said this: "We are proud to make a profit in all our businesses and intend to go on doing so. It is in our customers' best interest that the post office should be commercially motivated and that we should make profits to pay for growth and improvement in our services and repay loans." Now that speech, of course, could be made by managing director of ICI or Sainsbury's to their shareholders' annual meeting. Nothing is any different. Nationalisation is not socialism. It continues the production of commodity for sale at a profit. Socialism, of course, seeks the opposite, involving the abolition of buying and selling. Nothing under socialism would be bought or sold. There would be no production for sale. Production would be solely and directly for use. And that, of course, is what the Socialist Party have been saying ever since it was formed, and we should continue going on saying it until the workers recognise that by advocating and supporting nationalisation, it has been for the working class 50 appalling wasted years.
Thank you, Comrade Hardy. We'll have a short break for...
the Monopolies Commission that's been set up by the government. How much do you think they're under?